A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 23, 1994, entitled, Our Hearts Are Restless Until... The scripture readings are Acts 17, verses 16 through 34, and John 1, verses 1 through 18. The texts for the sermon are Acts 17, verse 27, and John 1, verse 9. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Our hearts are restless until, so goes the title of the message, and it comes, of course, from the oft-quoted statement of St. Augustine, whose claim was, Thou hast made us for Thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in Thee. And I do believe that. And the longer I am in the ministry, the more I am convinced of that. I remember coming into the ministry a rather scared and fearful and defensive person, wondering whether or not this enterprise into which I was entering had a future, being very fearful for the faith, worrying about what seemed to be at that time the unraveling of the world, and I was not a child of the 60s, the 50s, for goodness sakes. But such was my narrow, cribbed understanding of things. And now, looking back over more than three decades of ministry, I know that Augustine was right, because God has created the human person with a hole in the heart, with an empty space in the soul, which nothing can satisfy save resting in the grace of God. We may, in restlessness, struggle to stuff it full of all sorts of things, some destructive, some delightful, but finally, all of us really needs to know, wants to know, longs to know that God is, and that God is for us, and that grace is ours. Yes, Augustine was right, I'm sure of it. Thou hast made us for Thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in Thee. It seems as though we have come to a period in human experience when maybe there is again a more general recognition of that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, incarcerated for his attempt on the life of Hitler in the dark days of National Socialism, in the depths of the Second World War, wrote letters and papers from prison, which are a marvelous spiritual testament. And he spoke about man come of age, and he had the sense that God was being edged out of the world. And we all speak out of our own context, and his context was so vivid in his experience, of course. And he was reflecting a high point in human culture, in in the German civilization of the day, high point in so many respects, highly educated, the arts, culture, technology, scientific achievement. And it was though, in Bonhoeffer's perception, the human person and human society had come to the point where we could do without the hypothesis of God. The human person in charge, shaping and determining his or her own world, having the reins of one's own destiny in one's hands. I'm sure as Bonhoeffer traverses the celestial courts in the company of the Church Triumphant, he must shake his head at this near end of the 20th century. For less than half a century later, there is all kinds of evidence of belief on the part of the human person. Some of it's rather bizarre, but it is not at all true that the human person has come through stage after stage after stage to where finally superstition or belief or faith are no longer necessary or present. We are as believing, for good or ill, as superstitious, for good or ill, as gullible, for good or ill, as, I guess, any previous generation. There's a positive side to that, and that is a new openness, a new recognition that as Bonhoeffer was at the end of a couple of hundred years of constant development and achievement through the exercise of human reason, human rationality, and recognized the faithlessness of that, the assertion of human rationality and human autonomy, as he saw that and saw it almost as the end of the process, we can look back over the last decades and see that that making the human mind the measure of all things has brought us up empty. As I said last week, we have come to see that it is not seeing, it's believing. But then in that invisible world of spirit, it is rather believing as seeing. That is the perceptive mode by which we gain insight and understanding. And in this season of Epiphany, we celebrate the fact that that which is not available at the disposal of our human investigation has been given to us as gift in the gracious God who unveils that heart of love at the center of things deep down. This is what Paul discovered. I find myself returning to this experience of Paul in Athens again and again. It fascinates me. He had such chutzpah. Here he was, this Jew, convinced that God had spoken supremely in Jesus, who was the Messiah. He goes to the very font of Western culture and civilization, to the height of academic achievement, to Athens itself, and has the audacity, when asked about his beliefs, to say, "I saw an image. You are very religious. I saw an image written in the inscription to an unknown God. this unknown God whom you worship, I proclaim to you. Is that boldness? Is that daring? Is that the passion of faith and conviction? I guess it is. Some of you were with me in Athens this past September, and I stood at Mars Hill. And I even have a photograph to prove it. And we talked together about the experience of Paul in Athens. It disturbs me a little bit that Paul was disturbed when he came there, having done the city tour, because he was at the center of the highest achievement of human culture and civilization. And he was provoked. At least as Luke tells us the story, he was provoked because of the pantheon of gods and goddesses. And I want to say, Paul, don't you have some appreciation for the marvel that is this cultural achievement? Don't you have some sense of the glory that is Greece? But then I remember that Paul was catching that culture and civilization as its flame was fading. He was seeing only the dying embers of what once had been the brilliant light, the most brilliant light of human achievement. Cultures have their dawn and their zenith, and they're fading away. And so perhaps I can forgive Paul for not standing in awe on Mars Hill in the presence of the Parthenon. Because what he saw on the marketplace at that time, 500 years now after the golden age of Greece, what he saw there were the academic intellectual discussions that had become mere play, mere games. They weren't serious anymore. They lacked passion and conviction. They were just philosophical discussions, the way to spend an idle hour. They enjoyed this kind of thing. Luke tells us that they did nothing but discuss things and ideas all day long. Well, that can be a wonderful pursuit, but it can also be an empty pursuit, a superficial pursuit, a pursuit that has not the pulsing passion of life and conviction about it. That's what Paul ran into. When he came to Athens, he was at a hinge point in history. 500 years after its glory, it had degenerated into mind games. And he proclaimed Jesus. And he said, "The God whom you grope after. You're very religious." Paul didn't say that was of no account. He didn't denigrate it. He acknowledged the quest. He honored the yearning. And then he said, "Let me tell you about the one who is behind all of those representations that you have set out in your pantheon of gods and goddesses. Let me proclaim to you the one who is the font of life, the creator who gives us life and breath, the one in whom we live and move and have our being. This one I declare to you, this one who has become unveiled to us in Jesus. This man appointed by God to reveal, to redeem, to judge, and to save." Paul proclaimed Jesus as the light that gives insight into the heart of God, which is what John, of course, testified to in the marvelous prologue to his gospel. This one who is light and life coming from the God who is the source of life and light. This one becoming flesh and dwelling among us so that we could behold Him. No one, John says, has ever seen God. But this one, as a Father's only Son, this one has made God known. That's what Paul believed. He had his own epiphany experience. Paul never turned his back on his own tradition either. Nor did he disparage Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and the law. But he had come deeply rooted in all of that to be uprooted suddenly in the brilliance of the light of the risen one who encountered him and called him to take this light of the knowledge of the eternal God to the nations. This God whose heart was laid bare in the flesh of Jesus. And so at that critical hinge point in history, Paul was able to let go, as it were, and not to cling to all of that that had absolutely shaped him and formed him and about which he had conviction and passion. He was able to let go in order to respond to the heavenly vision. He says, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. Believing in the Christ reigning, present in the Spirit, he came to Athens, mighty Athens itself, in a time of its own decline, to say, here is light, and here is life. The eternal God whom you seek, the God whom you grope after, this insatiable hunger in the human heart, this inevitable yearning and groping, satisfied through the God unveiled in Jesus Christ. That's the story of Epiphany. And that's the God in whom we believe. And our hearts are restless till we find our rest in that God. I used to wonder whether the enterprise into which I was entering as a young preacher had any future. With white-knuckled intensity, with great defensiveness and fear, overcompensating, I suppose, with bombast, I tried to hard sell the gospel, not knowing that there is a hole in the human heart. If only we can find access, because the human heart is hungry for God, and human beings are insatiably religious. And we are learning again in our day that it is not seeing that is believing, but that faith itself is a manner of perception, and that in believing we see. But even then, I can't stop there. For the moment I believe and I see, I'll begin to think again. And when I begin to think again, I'll find that my heart cannot long rest where my mind cannot follow. I was going to bed last night at midnight. And I set the alarm, and suddenly I got the notepad out and scratched something down. Nancy said, bingo. I said, bingo. That's it. The heart cannot long rest where the mind cannot follow. if that resting place in God, which might happen in an overwhelming moment, cannot be tested by our experiences in full light of all that we know and understand, its foundation will not last. And therefore, for our day, just as Paul did for his day, as Martin Luther did for his day, at every hinge point in human history, what we need to do today, also at the end of an age, perhaps at the twilight of Western culture and civilization, twilight not because of some inevitable historical determinism, but because conviction and passion dissipates, confusion reigns, an easy tolerance, a lack of conviction. Maybe at the end of this our Western cultural experience, what we need to do is find the way to say Jesus Christ today, for tomorrow. I heard a very eloquent speaker recently who represents the very finest of evangelicalism, who gave a very accurate and articulate description of our contemporary situation with its confusion and with its chaos and with its crises. And his call was to go back and to capture the clarity and the conviction of the 16th century. And I wanted to stand up and say, no, you can never go back. That which ignited passion and instilled conviction, because it was the confession and the profession of the moment in its context, can never simply be dusted off and polished up and set and used again. What we need to do is to believe so deeply today in the grace of God that we'll be able to let go of all of that that has shaped us and formed us. Not afraid, but trusting the Spirit who beckons us into the future, the Spirit whom Jesus said would come and lead you into all truth. Even John, even at that day, recognized that there were things they could not handle but would be revealed subsequently by the Spirit. And why should we believe that that process ever stopped? Just as Paul had to let go in order to proclaim something grander and brighter than ever he knew, so us, for us today, to be able to rest in that grace. Because our hearts are restless. So we rest in God. But resting there, then with freedom and joy, to find the way to say to our neighbors, to those with whom we work, to our family, our children and grandchildren, come walk with us in the light, which is the life, which has come to us from the eternal God who created all things and whose heart was laid bare in Jesus Christ our Lord. Come walk with us, for you're hungry, and there's food and drink in this one, said maybe in a new way, new shapes and forms. Nonetheless, the same light, the light of the world, Jesus Christ,